You know, the human mind is truly a fascinating instrument with its capacity to learn new things and to remember, to be able to devise complicated plans and then also to anticipate potential problems. I mean, the human mind is truly fascinating. However, the older I get, the more I realize how it's getting harder and harder to remember simple things. Why did I go into the kitchen? How old are my children? I mean, simple things you think would be engraved in my mind can be gone in an instant. And you think, where in the world do they go? And how do I remember that? The mind is truly intricate and fascinating. When people my age and older were young, we memorized who knows how many numbers, phone numbers, that we had to know by heart. You could not simply tap on a name on your phone and it would call them. You had to know their phone number. And believe it or not, the city actually printed for free and gave to every home books that had everybody's phone number in it. Now imagine that with privacy laws today. But we memorized so much. And I honestly can't tell you one of my children's phone numbers because I just tap on a name and it calls them for me. But our minds, memory is fascinating and so essential to our well-being in many ways. The mind is fascinating. Well, in today's passage, Paul gives us a lesson that I think in some ways could be summed up by the old saying, those who cannot remember the past are doomed to repeat it or condemned to repeat it. History is extremely important because the lessons that others have learned in the past can teach us to avoid some of the same things that they went through. I remember in seminary, and some of the details I don't remember, but I do remember this friend in class asking Dr. Raymond, who was our systematic theology professor, about interpreting. It was something to do with the relationship of Jesus to the Godhead. And he asked, would it be possible, Dr. Raymond, to interpret it this way? And those are the details. I can't remember what he said. But I do remember what Dr. Raymond said. Dr. Raymond said, dear brother, you could interpret it that way. But if you did, you would be condemned by a heretic based on the Council of Chalcedon. And he went on to give us a history lesson on the church fathers. And I remember, one, being so embarrassed for my friend for what he said. But then also, secondly, being so impressed with the knowledge of history and how it protects you from such horrendous mistakes. Paul was a great student of history. He understood the Old Testament. He knew that God's people needed to remember the Old Testament and the examples that were given to us and to learn from them. Now, the city of Corinth, in which this church existed, the city was an extremely idolatrous society. Many within the church had been converted from pagan idol worship. So at the end of chapter 10, we didn't read the whole chapter. It would be fun to do the whole thing. That's one reason why I'm growing less fond of this process that I'm doing this year and reading through it and preaching sporadically through it, because now I want to go back and preach the whole book of 1 Corinthians now. I've never preached through 1 Corinthians, but you know, you have 66 books of the Bible. I've only been here 20 years, so it's going to come up. There's books I haven't preached. But if we could have, we would see at the end of chapter 10 that there were people that were concerned with an issue of eating food that were offered to idols. What do we do? It may seem odd to that topic that the Holy Spirit would inspire Paul to include that in his holy word. Well, does that have to do with us today? But it serves as an example for us. He backed up into chapter 9. Paul defended his authority as an apostle by making the same basic point. He said he had the authority or the right to do various things, and he lists some things out. But he was willing to forfeit those rights for the sake of the gospel. So also when it comes to the food that is offered to idols, he says there's nothing sinful in and of itself to eat that food. But if it offends your brother, if it causes your sister to sin, forgo that right. for the sake of your unity, for the sake of the gospel, don't exercise your perceived rights. As a way to demonstrate your love for one another, be your brother's servant. And so in verse 19 of chapter 9, he says, "For though I am free from all, I've made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them." And again in verse 22, basically again, "I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some." Now as he moves into chapter 10, he gives several examples of from the Old Testament of people who misused the gifts of God that he had given to them and how they suffered God's discipline, but are for our instruction. And so he began by listing multiple ways in which God's people were blessed abundantly. So that's the first point. God's people were blessed abundantly. We see that in the first four verses. Let's quickly run through them. I think it would be a great study to pause on each one and have a month of sermons diving into the Old Testament. But I really want to focus on more upon the point, the main point that Paul is driving us toward. These first two main points that I have are really illustrations for the main point. It's important to see how they were blessed, and it's important to see how they failed. But Paul is using this to illustrate a very important point, and we'll get to that at the end. So let's not get unnecessarily, let's not pause as much as I would like to, though I probably will pause more than I plan to. But as we look at the scenery on our way to the destination, Paul says in verse 1, "I don't want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud." Not Dropbox, not some streaming service, but literally under the cloud. You remember your Bibles, you remember how Jacob and his family made their way to Egypt during a severe famine. And after Jacob and Joseph died, the people of God spent 400 years in slavery in Egypt. Eventually, God raised up Moses to deliver them from the Egyptians so that they could go to the promised land. Remember, God sent the 10 plagues upon the Egyptians, and he miraculously delivered them, and they headed out. And in Exodus 13, we read, "And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night." And so the first blessing that they have is that they were led by God's guiding presence. God guided his people. They passed through also, he says, the sea. As they made their way to the promised land, they discovered Pharaoh once again changed his mind, and he was chasing them. They cried out to Moses in absolute panic and fear. And Moses goes to God. And he tells them, just go through the Red Sea. In Exodus 14, we read, "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land. And the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right and on their left." So the second way that they were blessed is that God protected them. He guided them with the cloud, and he protected them by allowing them to pass through the sea on dry land. Then there's a fascinating phrase. Thirdly, that they were baptized into Moses. This is not the time to get into a deep dive on the topic of baptism, because that's not Paul's intention. That's not what Paul is attempting to do. He uses the word baptism because it illustrates the point. Baptism identifies us with Christ. It marks us as God's children. Now, I think this can be confusing because of a common misconception about baptism. Many of our brothers and sisters think baptism is our way of making a promise to God. But it's actually just the opposite. It's actually a sign that God has given to show us his promises. It is our recognition of his promise to his people. Even John MacArthur, a wonderful Baptist pastor, makes this point in his own commentary when he says the Israelites were baptized into Moses in the sense that they were identified with him as the Lord's appointed leader over them. There was solidarity between the people and Moses. So basically, Paul uses this word to refer to being unified as a people under one leader, Moses. We are identified with Moses. God guided them, protected them, gave them a leader. And then he says in verse 3 that they all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. And this obviously is a reference to the manna and the quail and to the water. While the people of God were wandering through the wilderness, which they did for 40 years, God provided food and water. He gave them quail and manna every day. He says the food was spiritual. Now, that's interesting. We think, well, no, it's physical. It's quail and manna. But Paul's saying this was spiritual food because, not because it's something non-physical, but because it was divinely directed by God. It was provided by God. Not because it was some unusual quality, but it was from Him. And at least on two occasions, God provided them water from the rock. Now, it's fascinating that Paul, again, calls it spiritual because God provided it for His people. But also, look at verse 4 again, where Paul explicitly states that God provided this through Christ. For they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. As I was studying that this week, that really struck me, like I'd never seen it before. I've read this many times in the past. What do you mean the rock followed them? How does a rock follow you? Well, the Jews believed, and seems to be confirmed by Paul, that the rock that Moses struck followed them throughout the wilderness wanderings and was indeed a pre-incarnate Christ. Now, that was a Jewish belief. Seems possible that that's what Paul means by the rock followed them. I'm not going to stand here dogmatically and say that there was a rock that followed them everywhere they went, but it seems like that may be what it means. But clearly, it points to Christ. That they were to see the provision of food and water as a provision from Christ Himself. This points you to Him. Points you to your Messiah. The rock in Moses' time was a representative sign of the Messiah who protected and sustained His people. So God provided tremendous blessings to His people. Guided them, protected them, gave them leaders, gave them food and drink. And He still provides tremendous blessings to His people. Now, as a result, you would think that His people would be filled with gratitude. They would be thankful and wonderfully obedient to God. But if you know your Old Testament, you know that's not true at all. And neither are we today, sadly. So secondly, first, God's people were blessed abundantly. Now, secondly, Paul tells us that God's people sinned abundantly. And again, he lists several ways. In verse 5, he says, "Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness." That word overthrown, by the way, is now we sometimes talk about the importance of being prostrate before God, of casting ourselves face down before God, humbling ourselves. This word means to be prostrated before God, to be put down into the presence of God. They were humbled, they were brought low, they were struck by the holiness of God through the wilderness wandering. In fact, as you read the Old Testament, you'll find that the entire number of adults who left Egypt, estimated to be at least 1 million people, only 2 made it to the promised land, Joshua and Caleb. Even Moses and Aaron were disqualified because of their disobedience. Now, it does not mean that they lost their salvation. God received Moses into His presence, but he was not permitted to enter the promised land because of his disobedience in striking the rock. God caused his people to wander and wander and wander for 40 years until that whole generation died, saving Joshua and Caleb. And in verse 6, it says, these things took place as an example for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. The people of God disqualified themselves from the blessing and effective service because they displeased God. And so just as Paul gave us a list of blessings in the first four verses, now in verses 7 through 11, he gives us a list of their sins as well. Verse 7, don't be idolaters as some of them were. And then he references Exodus 32, a truly despicable story in the history of Israel. Moses goes up on the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments from God's hand. He's there for several weeks, and the people, as you remember, become impatient. They have Aaron there, but they don't have Moses. What are we going to do? We don't know if he's ever coming back. They ask Aaron to give them a golden calf. They begin to worship this idol. They begin to praise this idol for delivering them out of Egypt. Don't be idolaters like they were, Paul says. And in verse 8, we must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. On that occasion, the people gave themselves to the daughters of Moab. God had told them, do not intermingle with the nations. Don't give your children in marriage to the nations. And the Moabites were a wicked, vile nation. And God brought severe judgment on his people, and 23,000 in a day perished because of it. Verse 9, Paul says, we must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Similar sin, two different occasions. In the first occasion, the people of God put him to the test, and when they spoke out against him. In Numbers 21, they said to Moses, to God, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there's no food and no water. We loathe this worthless food. And God disciplined them and put many of them to death by sending poisonous snakes. And the second example of grumbling comes in number 16, where this began with a few men, and then it influenced the whole nation. It said in number 16:41 that on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and against Aaron, saying, you have killed the people of the Lord. And God was so furious at their complaints about his justice that he immediately sent a plague, and nearly 15,000 of them died because of it. Now, a fascinating detail of that Paul includes is that the destroyer was sent. That's the same name for the angel that God sent on the 10th plague that came through and killed the firstborn of Egypt. I don't know if we should put a whole lot into it, but it is fascinating to me. It's the same title, seemingly the same destroyer. So now we're finally getting to the main point that I think Paul really wants us to see. We've seen the variety of blessings that God provides to his people and how they were guilty of displeasing God through the sins of idolatry and sexual immorality, of putting God to the test and grumbling against God and his leaders. So what does Paul want us to learn from these Old Testament examples? Well, the climax comes in verse 12 and 13. We can enjoy the blessings of God and avoid the sins because God is faithful. It's not our doing. But we can truly enjoy the blessings of God and avoid sin because God is always faithful. Look at what he says in verse 12. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. And he gave us the examples, and there are many more, of how God's people have fallen when they thought they were standing. When we are abundantly blessed by God, when we are standing in a world that it seems to be just falling apart all around us, it's tempting for us to boast in what we have done. Well, we saw that last week when we were in chapter 1. Let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. It's tempting for us, however, when we are recipients of the blessings of God, Start boasting on what we've accomplished. We must never take credit for the blessings that God has given to us, but we must enjoy them. He still guides us. He protects us. He provides for us, just like he did for his Old Testament people. All the blessings that we have received in this life are from his hands. But we tend to think, especially as men, that we have accomplished great things. Our promotions, our sales, our bonuses are all the result of our hard work, our creativity. Look what we have done. No, remember what God has said through his servant James. In James 1:16, don't be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights. Every blessing is from his hands. We cannot take credit for what we have received, but we can certainly rejoice. We can certainly give thanks and give God the glory for them. Yes, indeed, we must glorify God and enjoy him forever. And so in the midst of all the blessings that God has rained down upon us, and we are abundantly blessed people, we also need to acknowledge the mud and the muck of this world and our own tendency to walk in it and enjoy it. God has not promised to shield us from every temptation. He has not promised to shield us, but he has promised to see us through them. And so again, verse 13, we read, "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it." That's one of the first verses that I remember memorizing as a young man. It's always been a great encouragement to me. Always. Because we all face temptation. All the time. But the good news in this is that God is faithful. He is faithful. He does not allow us to be tempted beyond what we are able to handle. But he also provides a way of escape so that we can endure it. There's a popular, but I think a terrible teaching today that gives people a false hope in this. You often hear people say that God will never give you more than you can handle. But that's nonsense. We all know that we go through many, many painful experiences in this life that we cannot handle on our own. And that's the problem with this popular teaching, because the emphasis is on you. God will never give you anything that you can handle. That's not what Paul is emphasizing. Paul is emphasizing that God will not give you what you cannot bear because of him, because he is faithful, not because of your great strength. Yes, there's a sense in which you can say that God will never give you more than you can handle, but only as you relate it to his faithfulness, to his strength, to his power, to his goodness, to his mercy. Yes, we can endure all things because we're united to Christ. You see that word temptation, and I used to do this all the time, that I would always try to differentiate between temptation and trial, but when you look at the Greek, there's really no difference. It can be translated as trial and testing as well. We go through many things in life that are more than we can handle. I can't even, I've been to more funerals for babies than I would ever want to be at. I can't imagine approaching the parents who were absolutely crushed and telling them, you know, don't cry, God never gives you more than you can handle. Obviously, that's not what Paul is saying in this verse. He's not saying that because you can be stronger than that, God will give you the strength to endure it. He will enable you to persevere. He will provide you the way out so that you won't fall into sin when you're in the midst of that trial, in the midst of that temptation. He will guide you and protect you and bless you. He is faithful. That's the point that Paul is driving us at in this entire passage. He was faithful to his Old Testament children. He guided and protected and blessed them. And they turned against him. Don't be wicked like they were. Recognize the faithfulness of God. Rejoice and give thanks for his blessings. But lean on him. Trust in him. Rely on him. You see, that's Paul's point. Every time we face a trial or temptation to sin, we can overcome it because we are united to Christ. We've been baptized into Christ, identified by him and with him. He is our strength. God has provided everything that we need to be able to stand. But when we stand in our own strength, beware lest you fall. We'll see this more even next week when we move into chapter 11 and the greatest blessings of the Lord's table. One of them is that it reveals our communion, our unity with Christ and with his people. And so when we come face to face with a trial or with a temptation, we're not alone. Whatever you're facing, it's not uncommon. It's not something that you only have to deal with, and nobody else has had to suffer like this. You're not alone. You are united with Jesus Christ, who was tempted in every way just as we are, yet did not sin. You're united with your brothers and sisters in Christ, who have also been tempted like you are. He has given us everything we need in order to resist temptation and to endure trials, to stand faithfully in the midst of anything when we are united with Christ. Well, let me try to be a little more practical in addressing, particularly dealing with temptations. John MacArthur listed three ways for us to endure. Three maybe simple, seemingly obvious, but given to us by God, to enable us to endure trials and temptations. First, he says, we must pray. Now, I know that sounds like a Sunday school answer, but prayer is the God-given means to strengthen us and to enable us to stand. I know it's even tempting as you sit here to hear the pastor say that you need to pray. You think, oh yeah, we always hear that. Shame on us. Shame on us for having such a low view of prayer. Prayer is one of the primary means that God has given to you to be able to endure whatever you're going through in life. Unfortunately, however, it's one of the last things that we do when we go through trials. We weep and we moan and we wail and we ask other people for sympathy and help. And then finally, eventually, we'll pray. Now, I know that's not everybody, but many of us, that's the way we are. This is one of the primary means that God has given to us. In fact, Jesus told his disciples to watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. Our first defense when we face these trials and temptations ought to be to cry out to God in prayer. Don't underestimate what our faithful God can do as you humble yourself before him and you submit your circumstances to him. Pray. Secondly, we must trust when we pray. We must believe that God will answer. Now, we don't know how God's going to answer initially, but we must trust that God is going to hear our prayer and answer us. We must believe whatever the temptation that God has allowed it to come for our good, to prove our faithfulness and to grow us in holiness and to bring him even more glory. We must, as we saw last week, we must recognize that all things that God is doing in us and through us is for his glory and our good. We must trust him and trust his plans. And third, we must focus our attention on Christ. In Hebrews 12, verse 3, we read, consider him, obviously Christ, consider Christ, who endured from sinners such hostility against himself so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. Consider Christ. Keep your focus on him. Intentionally drill down on Christ. He is my sole focus and must be. If I'm going to endure this trial, if I'm going to be able to resist this temptation, I must focus on Christ. He endured more than we could ever imagine. And he understands our trials and temptations, and he is able to take us through them. Turn your focus to him. Again, God has given us tremendous blessings. Nevertheless, we also recognize that trials and temptations, as long as we live in this world, are going to come. They came to the children of God in the Old Testament. They gave to us as examples, and it's entirely possible for us also to ignore our blessings and to fall into sin. Oh, may God help us. May God grant us his grace to take hold of his promises that he will see us through every temptation, that he will enable us to endure every trial.